The Senate Judiciary Budget Division Committee will come to order. Today is Thursday, March 8th, the year 2007. We're in room 125 in the Capitol, and we're prepared to start this morning with the number two on the agenda, Senate File 1614, Senator Bonham.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here today to talk to you about a bill that is very personal to me. I'm here with Vicki Seliger-Swenson, and Vicki lives in my community. She actually has been a teacher at the high school my children go to, and her husband was my son's teacher and coach, and so we know the family. And we're very struck this past summer when Vicki's sister was brutally murdered. And so she is here today to tell her story. And because of what she and her family have gone through and the horrible tragedy, we have created three separate bills in hopes of doing something in memory of Vicki's sister. And so we actually were in Senator Higgins' committee yesterday with regard to a bill on no contact orders. And today we're here before you to add some specific features to some legislation that already exists. And so rather than take you through that bill at this point, I think our time is better spent first hearing from Vicki, and then I do have Paula here to answer technical questions.
All right. Vicki Swenson?
Yes.
Please identify yourself for the record and so we can record here.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Vicki Seliger-Swenson, and thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm here to talk about my sister, Terry Lee. My sister was the 15th woman killed in Minnesota in 2006 by an intimate partner, and also killed that fatal morning was Timothy Hawkinson Sr., a man she planned to marry, whom we all loved and adored. But to us, my sister was more than number 15. She was a daughter, a sister, a mother, and a friend. And I'll tell you briefly about who she was. She was married for 8 years and had four beautiful children with a man named Ty Lee. And he died in a car accident in 2001. And with the love and support of my parents and our family and friends, she rallied around those four children, ages 1, 3, 5, and 7, and did an outstanding job raising them by herself. 2 years later, she began dating a man she knew from 3M, where they both worked. He was a trusted colleague, a 25-year employee, no criminal history. They shared some mutual friends, and he seemed safe. They dated on and off for nearly 2 years before she ended the relationship last spring for good. And he was relentless about them being together, to the point where on July 29th, 2006, he broke into her home and attacked her with butcher knives. She escaped when her neighbor saw his car and had called Terry to warn that he was in the driveway as he broke into her front door, and she then called 911. He fled to Wisconsin. He was later arrested and charged with second-degree assault, burglary, and making terroristic threats. I'm proud of my sister because of her strong will and her determination. She did everything right. She followed the system. She testified to police. She pressed charges. She went to court. She testified in court and begged the judge for the safety of her and her four children. And to use her words that are documented in Washington County Courts, she said to the judge, "I have no doubt in my mind he will return to my home to kill me." And 2 days later, he was released after he posted bail. And one of the conditions, the judge in a no-contact order said that he was to have no contact with Terry, her parents, or her children. And he violated that contact order multiple times. After trying to contact her through mutual friends, there was an email sent from his father's computer asking for her to meet with him. And she did not reply. It was sent to her computer at 3M. She called 3M police and she called Maplewood police. Maplewood police came. Terry kept a copy of the no contact order, and the police officer explained to her that the no contact order said no direct contact, and this was indirect as it was sent from her father's computer. At that point, Terry had engaged in the he said, she said, and tried to explain to the police officer that no, it's direct or indirect, as stated by the judge in court to both of us. And the police officer responded that that's just his way of trying to get back together with you, and there was no arrest made. On September 20th, he showed up at her daughter's volleyball match at an away junior high. The coach had no idea what he looked like, and when my niece came off the court trembling, the coach, not really knowing what to do or where to go, it wasn't their junior high, found the principal's office, called Terry. Terry informed them, call 911. He again fled, but my niece had identified him. They had him on the school surveillance cameras, and witnesses at the volleyball match gave statements, but again, there was no arrest. Terry kept her kids home from school the next day, which was Thursday, September 21st, because she feared for their safety as well as hers, and no one knew what this man looked like. She tried desperately to obtain a picture of him. She went to 3M and asked for them to release his employee photo, which they wouldn't because of data privacy. But her goal was to distribute this no-contact order with a picture to neighbors. She lived on 3 acres. They never saw this man up close. But to neighbors, to teachers, to coaches, so that they could immediately respond instead of, well, are you sure it's him? This is just a piece of paper. So what she did not know, unfortunately, was his mugshot is public record. I did not know that. She did not know that. She brought in rolls of film to Target that had been sitting around for 2 years and took it to the one-hour photo. Still, she called later that day and left a message on my parents' voicemail. She came up empty-handed. She could not find a picture of him. Less than 24 hours later, our biggest fear became a reality.
Take your time.
I will. This doesn't get easier. I keep thinking the more you tell it, the easier it will get, but it doesn't. He broke into her home that Friday morning and shot Tim 3 times and Terry 6, killing them both. Terry's 2 daughters fled to a neighbor's house for help, while her 2 young boys hid in a closet for almost 2 hours before being rescued by members of the SWAT team. He recovered at Regents Hospital from a self-inflicted gunshot wound and a wound from a member of the SWAT team. He's now awaiting trial of 2 counts of murder in the first degree, and as we are right now, he has pleaded not guilty, which means my niece and my nephew, the 2 oldest, will testify in a month because this will go to trial as it is right now. There's been a lot of local and national interest in my sister's story. And I have asked repeatedly the question, why? Why my sister? And the common response has been, because she followed the system, she did everything right, and she's dead. And I'm here because I believe that with tragedy, we can create hope. And I think we have an opportunity as Minnesotans to create that hope and show people of our state and of our country that Minnesota is a safe place to be, and that we are committed to protecting women and their children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of this committee, of this witness?
Mr. Chair, I would just like to add, as a member of the Hopkins School District community, the whole community has been devastated by this loss, and the community has come together and held fundraisers, trying to do whatever they can for Vicki and her husband, Eric, who are now, you know, raising 7 children in a house that was designed for much less. And so it is also important to me to carry this legislation so that we can go back to the people of our community and say that that tragic loss you know, has meant a difference, that we tell the children of Hopkins High School that we were able to do something for the loss of Terry. So are people clear with this particular piece of legislation? Carla, did you want to speak about the legislation?
Please state your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Carla Ferrucci, and I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, and I'm just really here to offer any background information and to support Senator and Vicki with this bill. So I'm here for any questions and just to offer support.
Because this particular legislation adds a photo to the no contact order, and that there's a standard form, and that the form is entered into the CRIMNET data system, so that we just have one more safeguard against people not understanding who it is that is coming into contact. So this bill is a very simple bill. In addition, the mandatory training, which we were in yesterday, spoke about, that we are recommending that there be mandatory training for the peace officers with regard to how to handle these no-contact orders and the victims of domestic violence.
I can understand that. I know that I've done pro bono work in this area, and it's kind of a terrible situation because you can get a court order that mandates protection, but the end result is that it's no better than the paper is written on, or probably not as good even. So you got a really serious problem to deal with, and don't want to overpromise that we're going to do more for you by doing this, because we expect that this will be helpful, all right, but it's clearly not the end. In my experience in court, the judges don't have adequate information, and there's no way of following up on a lot of those things. I think we have Ms. Marshall here, because that's going through the court. Did you want to explain that? Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question or two, because it requires a state uniform statewide form. And, of course, I think one of the things that, you know, maybe perhaps Ms. Marshall can address this, is that, you know, of course, every case that comes before a judge, you know, has its own unique issues there. And the judge has to fashion the order to match the situation, because there are a variety of factors and the judge has to make decisions as to what type of no contact there should be, some limitations, and based upon the situation. I'm just wondering if a unified statewide form would be more difficult for the court to fashion the individual type of orders. Perhaps Ms. Marshall might be able to address that part.
Welcome to the committee. Ms. Marshall, will you please identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janet Marshall with the State Court Administrator's Office. In terms of a uniform form, coincidentally, and I brought it with me, we do have a statewide uniform form already. It has been developed, and it says draft on it right now because it's actually due to go to our policy committee on March 30th for approval, at which time it would be available statewide for all judges. More specifically, in response to Senator Betzel's question, we do have quite an extensive list of uniform forms that we put out on our computer system for judges. And then what they normally do is they download the form and then they personalize it with specific information on what they need. What our uniform form does not do, and this would be somewhat of a challenge to us, would be the piece of the legislation about the picture, because we do not in the court system have those pictures. That would be something that law enforcement would have.
Ms. Marshall, on that, when you get into the picture taking, you've got those biometric considerations also. This is a document that will be used in connection with the CRIMNET. Can you tell us anything about that and how that would affect it? Because you're either getting fingerprints or a picture or both in order to have the identity certain that you've got the right person.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think I understand the question. We either get the fingerprint when it comes with the arrest record, or in some instances, if there is no fingerprint, the judge will order the person to go give a fingerprint. That does go directly to CRIMNET. We don't hang on to those. Those do go to CRIMNET. The other piece that I forgot to mention is that coincidentally on Monday, there is a big meeting of people from the court system, people from BCA, CRIMNET, and the coalition has been invited, that they are at the point in time that they are starting to have some discussions about how we do get these no-contact orders into not just CRIMNET, but into our order for protection system. And that's the system that law enforcement often relies on in their squad cars to call up. Is there an existing order for protection? And we're now starting discussions on also putting this one in there. It'll take a little time, and it takes some computer stuff, but that's where we're already going.
Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Carla Ferrucci with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, and Vicki and I spoke yesterday. The intention of this bill is we're pretty aware that there is this work going on in the no-contact orders, but I started at my position in July, and it was one of the first calls I got was that the enforcement of no-contact orders was such a challenge and that the creation of a database would be helpful. And I think the intention of this bill is to support the courts and the BCA and CRIMNET to get that to happen. This is in support of the work that they're doing, and they have brought us to the table, and we appreciate that. I just wanted to say that for the record.
Sarah Betts.
Mr. Chair, I can certainly understand from Ms. Lee's situation, you know, the fact that she has the order in hand, and if nobody knows what the individual looks like, it's going to be awfully hard. And this does say, but the bill says, to the degree feasible, the form must require a photograph. Well, you know, and of course, Ms. Marshall just said, but the courts don't have any photos. You know, they're not in the photo business. The law enforcement side is. I don't know how ultimately we can get this married up and how the judge can sign an order that whatever the order the judge signs has to have the photo as part of it in order to make it meaningful, I would guess, because you can't have the judge sign an order and somebody else put a photo in because that photo may not be the right person, okay? So somehow those have to be worked out, and if it says to the degree feasible, and if everybody says, well, we haven't got that worked out, you know, it's not going to happen, so.
Sarah Engelbert.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And wow, it's just amazing what we do learn down here, and been involved in this in many years. And but frankly, shame on us for not having this done a long time ago. My concern is the same as Senator Betzel with the feasibility here. My concern is that yes, in fact, it is public data once they are arrested, but you're also going to have some that have not been arrested. That's where the real riff is going to come. Now, we can get that photograph from the Department of Licensing Bureau. I mean, we do it all the time in law enforcement. But that's going to take a significant amount of work, I'm thinking. But what a handy tool that would be. And we've walked these many times to have in the corner the photograph of the person. My only fear is that by not having, you know, I mean, we need it for everybody. If you've been in jail, it's public data. But if you have not been in jail and this is the first time, the only place you're going to get it is from the Driver's License Bureau, and that's depending upon whether the person has one. So, yeah, it needs some more. We shouldn't eliminate those.
Chair Liver.
Mr. Chair, I was questioning the feasibility, but a great number of years ago, we created a bill that transferred data from DNR, a conservation officer, to public safety, and that was to follow DWI records that may be involved in driving a vehicle, a motor vehicle, and married that information up with data that was collected by conservation officers when they were driving a recreational vehicle. And each incidence of DWI could be accumulated for the purposes of an enhanced violation. If they had three DWIs in a period of 5 years, that would trigger a felony DWI. And we wanted to track from one agency and department from another, and that all routed to the same source for data collection. I don't think this would be that difficult to do. It's just a matter of getting the adequate number of computer programming and the authorization to shift or make available. I would think it would be available for a court to order up a photograph of a driver's license photograph if they didn't have it from law enforcement or from corrections. And so, and would it be a timely photo would be probably another issue to bring up, but maybe the court could tell us what is the authority of the court to order a photograph from law enforcement or Department of Public Safety on their driver's license or transportation,
I think. Senator Limmer, I don't think that part of it is a matter of concern. Really, I think that the authority is there and so forth. What you may not be aware of is the CRIMNET process and the integration of the records of the BCA having the files there, and the goal of CRIMNET is that have these, they call them silos, set up where you extract that the information and create whatever you need in order to do that. The sad part of the record system and the CRIMNET is that a significant number of those biometric identifiers aren't there, and so what they have is the matter put in a suspense file, and in reality nobody can really tell what that is. So there are some problems inherent with the system, but I do think that this is a step in the right direction, and that my suggestion is that we approve this and that we give the court administration the opportunity. Apparently, they're already working on this issue. That give them the opportunity to have some funds if they have to do it in order to deal with that. Ms. Marshall, would you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, our only concern would be the photograph piece, as people have pointed out. When you call up a driver's license record, you get a driver's license record. You don't get pictures and all the pretty things. I would be very concerned about the delay that will be caused if you're sitting in court and you're signing no contact orders, which they often do right off at the bench, that you're then going to have somebody go sit, and you can't issue the order until you can track down a picture of the person. And we would have to go find a picture of the person. I don't know that it would even be, the picture would be available in the same county. You know, there's logistics of where you would find that picture of the person and how long would that delay the issuance of the no contact order.
I would think, Ms. Marshall, that the driver record that the BCA has contains a photo, so that access to that, no matter whether it was in Duluth or Rochester or any other point in the CRIMNET system, that you could do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Due to my birthday just happening in January, that triggered me to get a new driver's license. And the new driver's license, I got a yellow piece of paper, carbon paper, didn't have my photograph on it. But, you know, you fold this big piece of paper up and you stuff it in your wallet and you walk around with a limp for a month until you get the new driver's license with a photograph. Now, could the court do something like that, recognizing perhaps the photographic gap, issue the order pending the completed order with photograph? Is that something that the court could do? We understand the technological limitations of acquiring a photograph, but could we make something like that and have it allowable by law?
You know, you neglected to mention, though, that when you go in and get your license renewed, that in fact you have a current license, and what they do is cut the corner off and give it back, so you still have the picture ID.
Mr. Chair, it seems to me, though, that if a judge is sitting there and, you know, the judge is going to sign the order based upon the people in the courtroom, whatever they've told the judge, he decides that this is the case, he signs the order. If a photograph is going to come up at a later time, the judge is going to want to know, okay, is this the photo of the person who I'm trying, you know, to have the no contact order with? And so somebody's going to have to be back before that judge to say, yes, that's the person, because, you know, how is he going to know? Just, you know, he may get a driver's license photo, but he's going to be wary about, you know, marrying those two up unless somebody says that's it. So, because, you know, there might be two people, for instance, with the same name at the same address, a father and son, and what if we get the wrong person? So, how do you make that happen? I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Limmer.
Do you think that would be that much of a burden for someone who's being threatened with their life to come back to a court or to sign an affidavit that looks at a piece of paper and says, yep, that's the guy, and they sign it and they pass it on? Is that too much of a burden for them?
Well, Mr. Chair, Sarah Limmer, for an individual, for one case, no. If we're talking about every one of these no-contact orders to require two court appearances instead of one, I think it starts multiplying, and I think the court can probably address that much better than I can. I think we've got to figure out how do you make this work, and I don't know that we've got all those answers right now.
Mr. Chair, if I might, thank you. Perhaps the language in here with the when feasible is a step, and that really the process we can't work out in this room because we don't have all the information, but there is this group working on this problem. If they understand that there's an intent, and perhaps we even have an enactment date that gives them some time to work it out and has them report back to us, maybe we could have an amendment that has them get back to us on a plan of how that could be worked out.
Senator Bonoff, didn't you split this bill and you have the actual policy stuff setting someplace else? You're here only for a financial thing, then, plus the fact that it's an order for protection, and that is a judiciary responsibility, of course. But
Mr. Chair, so that means that with regard to the appropriation, you don't want to appropriate something unless you're clear how it's going to happen? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that would be helpful, but I'm not certain at this point that you need to go that far, that ultimately this is going to be moved into a larger bill, and whether it'll stay in there, whether I have the money to do what you need, and so forth. All of that has to be determined yet, both in our division and in the policy bill there. That Senator Benson.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, of course, sometimes, you know, when we don't know the answers, we do ask, you know, the affected agencies to kind of look it over and make a recommendation to us. Sometimes they ask, they attach a fiscal note to doing that. The first part of your bill, it appears to me, has already been taken care of, because it looks like the court has developed and is prepared to implement a unified statewide form for domestic abuse no contact orders. So
yes,
that, you don't need any legislation to do that, because the court's done that. It's the second part that we don't know the answer to, and I think we do need to hear from law enforcement, from BCA, from the courts and so forth, and perhaps if you do have a different bill in another committee or whatever, you know, maybe you can convert that over into some sort of a, you know, request for recommendations from the courts, from the law enforcement, from BCA, as to how to make this work. Because I think right now saying to the degree feasible raises more questions than it answers, and it doesn't accomplish anything.
Mr. Chair,
do it. Well, okay.
Mr. Chair and Senator Betzold, I almost think we're better off to take, then based on that, take the
if feasible, out and say, attach a picture and let them work out how, I mean, just food for thought in terms of if it would save lives. And we know that with technology being what it is, to scan a photo is so simple that if we direct.
Well, but Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, first of all, if you do that, then what happens if the court is sitting there with a victim in the courtroom and there's no photo? You're telling the court, don't sign the order because you don't have a photo. That's worse.
I agree, Mr. Chair.
And plus, too, I think regardless, we can put this in a statute, but the judicial branch being its own separate independent branch, even if we put it that way that you must have a photo for every order, the judge may say, well, I'm going to sign this order because I think we need an order here, and I know the legislature said to have a photo, but if I haven't got a photo, I'm going to do this anyway. So either way, it doesn't work. So I don't think that quite gets you there. I think you've got a good idea that needs to be followed up, but we just don't have logistically how you make that happen, given the fact that the people who take the pictures and have it have to be married up into the system so that the information can be gotten to the judge. And I think that if people can step back and kind of think about how to make this work, perhaps it can be done. But, I think we're not the ones to answer those questions, and other people are in a better position to do that.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the court system done any estimating of what this would cost if this was fully enacted?
Ms. Marshall, do you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, no, not yet, because this just was introduced maybe 2 days ago, and we're still working on the fiscal notes that are due right. We have not had time to do that.
Mr. Chair, how soon could the court determine a price on this? Or is there someone else that could offer a fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I think it's beyond the courts. We would have to a lot of this would be dependent on people like Department of Public Safety, if you want the driver's license pictures, the law enforcement who has the pictures. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who would have to be involved to make this work. It wouldn't be just the courts.
But realistically, Ms. Marshall, I think that the CRIMNET process is the way it's ultimately going to have to go. That was the whole design of that program, and I think we are moving forward. My knowledge of that, and I'm a sitting member of the task force, so I do know that, but you're currently working on this, or some the court administration has a team or work group or something?
Mr. Chair, what we're working with is BCA and CRIMNET on how do we get the information from these orders into the CRIMNET and the OFP system. We are not working on anything having to do with photographs. Okay. We're just trying to make sure that the OFP, that this stuff that will go to CRIMNET will also end up in the OFP system, because it's the OFP system that many law enforcement officers have in their cars now that they call up on their computers to see, is there an order for protection out there?
But you don't... on your side, have any access to any photos that you take yourself, that anything you get would have to come from another agency? Is
it? Mr. Chair, that's correct. And I think it is tied into probably the whole CRIMNET system and how we're all sharing data that way, as opposed to trying to go off on our own. And it's the same agencies, it's the same kind of information, but it would take some thinking and a lot of effort to implement to be able to completely do this, and it's not something that we could do quickly.
Senator Engelbrecht.
Mr. Chair, is there some way that we can make this happen fast? What I'm saying is that can the courts order, if the victim comes in for an order, the order is here, and accompanies a photograph of the person, would the court then be able to say, yeah, go ahead and legally attach that to the order, and at least deal with, somehow try to deal with this and tell this bureaucracy of how this stuff gets to wherever it's supposed to go as photographs? I don't know. Just
Mr. Chair?
Senator Betzel.
I don't see why a court could not do that. I mean, you can have an attachment to an order. Of course, the photo would have to go into the court file because that would be part of the official record, and then maybe most copy machines in the courthouse would come up with a black and white photo of something, and it may not be high quality. But, if you had, but a court could incorporate by reference, a photo in there, you may not need legislation to do that. The courts could probably do that on their own. We could probably, have something on the books that say that, an order for protection may include a photograph of the subject. I don't know. I think that would take a little bit more, more study and a little bit more thinking, but, something like that I think could happen, but... I don't know how many victims are going to come to court, though, with a photograph in hand.
Right.
And that's perhaps something that the victim's advocates, if they knew if something like that was out there, they could tell people when you go to court, find something, bring it to court so that if the judge is so inclined to attach it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold and Senator Ingebretson, this is relating to the criminal no contact orders. Mm-hmm. Once there's a criminal charge, and it sounds to me, and I'm not an attorney, that mm-hmm. what you're talking about is when victims come in for an order for protection, which is a different system. And we do often ask them to come with a photo so that can be entered into the court record, and when the defendant is served, they know who they're serving. But this is in the criminal system, which is part of the confusion, and it's dual things happening here, and I think that's part of what the concern has been, so that in some cases, and I think that maybe Terry's case would be that it doesn't fit the standards of orders for protection, or she doesn't have an advocate who's necessarily advocating for, you got the no contact order from the judge, now you need to go to the civil system and get a order for protection. So some women just only have the no contact order, and because it's not as we haven't advocated on the no contact side like we have with orders for protection, there isn't the same thoroughness about it. So as Ms. Marshall said, it's not in a database. Advocates aren't saying necessarily to carry the no contact order. They're actually saying go get an order for protection as well if you can, and we'll take you there because you need both, because these aren't law enforcement has no way to check these no-contact orders. So there's sort of two things going on here. There's no place to check the orders, and then there is how do we attach a photo to it so that when law enforcement is checking, if they only have the no-contact order, they can verify it. Do you see what I'm saying?
Nowadays, people have all kinds of digital cameras, for God's sakes. I can't see where we couldn't. And they're cheap besides. Really. Senator Ingebrigts.
This is sounding more and more like policy all the time here, Mr. Chair, but maybe something as simple as incorporated into this order, ordering law enforcement, once they take possession of this document, they now are required to go on the system, look up and attach the photograph to this order before it is actually put out there. Maybe that would be the simplest way. We can look it up. We have access to that immediately.
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
You want to pull that mic back?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I just would pose the question then, do they have access to everybody's photo? Because if you make a requirement that law enforcement has to do this and has to attach a photo, I think the judges would want some assurance that there would be a photo mm-hmm. available for mm-hmm. them to attach.
Follow-up. Yeah, you're talking about ex parte orders, so that mm-hmm. the defendant, if you will, won't be there in many instances on an arraignment, at least.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, follow up on that. I hate when the state of Minnesota makes mandates on law enforcement, but this is a good thing. I mean, it's just something that should be done. And I can't answer that, I guess, 100% whether we'd have access to. But I think we would have access to anything that the group is going to come up with. And we're going to have that same access at our hand. And if we're so ordered by the court to go into the DMV and pull the photo out and attach it to this form, or go into a CrimNet system, which hopefully will be up and running someday, where we can find out and be able to see the photos of everybody that's incarcerated or has been incarcerated in all our county jails, which has been a system we've been looking for many years. Yeah, they may have access, probably as good of access as anybody's going to have. But 100%, I don't know if you can guarantee that.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Lehman.
Couldn't we put somewhere into the writing, if available, or if any, the most recent photograph, if available, and that way the... If there is a photo, it goes, and if it doesn't, we know that that may be a possibility, that there may not be a photograph. And wouldn't that be at least enough room for doing it? But if there was no photograph, it would, we're recognizing an allowance that they may not have that.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Limmer, I was wondering if Mr. Baucus has an opinion about how we might...
Mr. Chair and members, if the idea is to put any kind of substantive requirement for peace officers in this bill, I mean, there is that separate bill that's going through judiciary that was supposed to deal with the nuts and bolts of essentially how to do this, and then this was going to be a placeholder to appropriate money to do that. So I think that other bill is presumably going to be heard there and, I guess, fix that issue. If you wanted to do something substantive like that here, then I guess this bill would have to then go to judiciary. Because it's a policy issue.
So perhaps, Mr. Chair, Mr. Baucus, we could just leave this still as a blank appropriation, as a placeholder, and let the bill travel through policy. And when that happens, circle back.
I think you're right. The trouble with this committee and the others is there's always a tendency to try and fix things before we get out of there. And sometimes we have people fixing things that aren't within their purview. I think from my standpoint, why I would request that one of you members recommend this to pass and be sent to finance, I think.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know that we're quite... have all the answers, and I think it'd be more prudent if we just laid it over, and if we get the answers in the near future, we can probably act on it. I hate to send it to finance unless we're satisfied that all the questions have been answered, and I don't think we're quite there yet. But maybe depending on what's happening in the Judiciary Committee and this one, we can quite get there. And I think.
So your motion is what?
Just lay it over, Mr. Chair. I think you have the authority just to lay the bill over, and then if we can get some further information, certainly Senator Bonhoff can come back before us, and we can look at it again. But I think by setting a finance, we're saying, okay, we're satisfied, we're done, and I don't think this division is quite there yet.
You're right, Senator Metzl. I think. Lay that over for possible consideration in the judiciary finance.
But I don't think we're quite at the point we're going to say we're ready to consider it yet, because we have to work out some more details before we even are there. And I think just laying it over keeps it open, you know, for further discussion if that's the desire of the budget division. So I think that'd be the more prudent question. If we say we're laying it over for further consideration, I think that implies that we're done with the bill. And I don't sense we are quite done right now. So I would...
Well, I'd accept your motion.
Mr. Chair, I would just recommend that the chair just lay the bill over and then hold the bill until if you're prepared to put it back on the agenda for further discussion, we can do that then.
I would agree with that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Betzold, my concern about... I do agree there's things to be worked out. My concern, if it's the bill is just laid over, is that as you're putting together your bill in the next couple days, I was hoping that you might consider putting some money aside as a placeholder, and without some affirmation by this committee that you're interested in proceeding in this direction, I'm afraid that you won't be open to doing that as you put together your bill. So while we don't have the details worked out, and it is going to be going through policy, is there some way to accommodate that concern yet this session? I would hate to have us go on a whole nother year without having this policy be moving forward.
Mr. Chair, Sarbanoff, I agree it would be nice to do it, but until you work out the details, you can't get a fiscal note that tells you what it cost. Placeholders are not going to help you unless you get a fiscal note that says this is how to do it, where you're going, and what the cost is going to be. And I'll be honest with you, I don't think that's going to happen within the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold, there's a chance of it happening if we do, in some affirmative way, allow it to be a placeholder. I think there's no chance if we don't. The worst that can happen is we don't end up being able to do anything with it this year, but at least we leave that door open. That's what I'm asking you to consider is...
But I think what Senator Petzl said is that there's really little or no difference other than there's no recommendation for any action. And so it's my intention to take Senator Betzel's advice and lay the matter on the table.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold, if we find out that it was more simple than we thought to attach this picture and came back to you...
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, let Senator Foley know and ask him to put it back on, and he knows how to manage his agenda.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll be here.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Marty, Senate File 859.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 859 is largely in different, bigger mental health bill, and actually I believe only one provision in it is under the jurisdiction of this committee. That would be on page 3, the subdivision 3 of the appropriations of mental health courts. And we've got Hennepin and Ramsey County mental health courts in Minnesota have been, I think, a very positive thing. The growth of mental health courts around the country is happening very quickly. And we've unfortunately used the court system in the as a means of dealing with mental health issues because we failed to deal with mental health issues in better ways. But we're trying to get here, what we'd be looking for would be some funding, and there are blank appropriations. I think we'd love to see, ideally, $150,000 each year for two purposes, one of which is not stated here. I think we'd need an amendment to do so if going ahead. One of which would be to have the Supreme Court develop and implement standards for mental health courts because we know what's been successful in working them, and we'd like to have that be what's used, the model statewide, and also to provide grants to try and establish a couple more courts, which we think $300,000 would do. Again, recognizing the budget restraints and everything, that's a decision you'll have to make, but we would like to make the case that this does save money. Just last week, a week ago, the RAND Corporation did a study of mental health courts, particularly ones in Pennsylvania. We have some handouts that mentions, they have a copy of this just March 1st, that talk about how mental health courts have great potential to save taxpayers money, make better use of our jails and tax dollars, increase public safety, and make our communities healthier. Because, again, giving people, 10 generally low-level offenders, giving them access to the intervention they need to address their mental health issues is a big plus. And so with that, I have Sue Abderhogen, the executive director of NAMI Minnesota, here to speak to it. But we're just looking at that little, the last three lines of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Sue Abderhalden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And, as you know, kind of the increasing numbers of people with mental illness in our criminal justice system is a concern of everyone involved, whether it's police, the courts, jail administrators, prisons as well. And mental health courts are a type of problem-solving court. They came about in the mid-90s, and we're seeing them really kind of blossom around the country, much more in other states than, frankly, in Minnesota. Last year in Hennepin County, they served about 350 people through their mental health court. Judge Hopper has stated that he's found it to be extremely successful. You know, you're really treating people, you're really increasing public safety by doing that as well. It's not just a way to kind of get off. You're really treating this illness effectively. And, of course, these usually are nonviolent offenses. And we just see it as a really good investment in both people and in our public safety.
Ms. Aberholm, can you do you have any data to indicate numbers of the people that were processed through these courts and what the results were and the general why we should deal? I mean, the committee has been down and we've looked at the various drug courts and mental health courts and others, and in order to know we're going to commit money to that, we need to have some evidence that what these things will do is help people out and get out of the system or whatever the end result goal is. Can you tell us anything about that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, unfortunately, neither Judge Hopper nor Judge Johnson could come today to testify and report on their findings. But what the evaluation data has shown, particularly in Hennepin County, since it's been around for a little bit longer, is that there is less recidivism, that people are actually becoming more stable in the community because they're getting housing, they're getting treatment. They're able to, in a sense, keep people, following their treatment plan because their other alternative then is to go into jail. Nationwide, they're finding that this is cost-effective, as the RAND report states. It is a good practice. The Consensus Project report, which was done by the Council of State Legislators, really recognized this as a really good way to go. And that report, as you know, was kind of held up as the Bible in terms of what to do to reduce the number of people with serious mental illness in our criminal justice system.
I want you to know that, and you probably do know, that I'm deeply committed to various actions in the area of mental health and recognizing that this is just one of the tools that we're talking about. But by and large, as I get back to the evidence versus the money, and I think perhaps Sarah Marty, you might be able to enlighten us a little bit about where this will take us. What are the number of people and I assume that most of those that you're talking about in these court structures are folks that not only are mentally ill but they also have committed a serious crime of some nature.
Mr. Chairman, when I heard the presentation of Judge Hopper to the Legislative Mental Health Caucus, I can't remember quite when it was, but it was a very impressive presentation, and unfortunately a lot of what I took away from it was anecdotal things about how it had made a difference for people who were basically being recycled into the court system over and over again. I do not have statistics, and I think I'd be happy to try and do is get some concrete numbers. The trouble is because they haven't been around that long, and it tends to be more anecdotal because every case is so different. But I think we can certainly try and provide the committee with whatever we can get from the two courts.
The problem you're facing, of course, is timeliness and how that all work out. But it seems to me that this is a long-term program and one that should dictate, where this specialty court is going to be and what are the affected results that you're going to produce, what's going on nationally and otherwise. Tell me about that.
And Mr. Chairman, I think one of the reasons that we're looking for funding for developing standards is because, again, the people involved in the courts in these two counties, and again, the same trend in other states on this, they found it to be very successful, and there are certain things that seem to work well, and we'd like to have the court sort of lay out a process for other counties as the other court systems as they go into this. So if another judicial district chooses to do so, we have the model spelled out. And we were, of course, hoping that there could be some funding to actually, doesn't take a lot to get them started, but to give a little bit of incentive money to get some more districts to join in. Again, I realize the timeliness issue, and we can check with the courts and see if we can get any concrete numbers instead of anecdotal information.
That, Senator Marty, would seem to be the way to go, is to look at and see what's going on. And we do have the example of Hennepin County to work on, but there certainly must be more data available from other jurisdictions.
And, Mr. Chairman, that RAND Corporation study that just came out last week, we can go through the full report. And, again, that's not Minnesota's. That was based on Pennsylvania, but the RAND Corporation was saying that they're finding the same thing true in other states, too, that it's been pretty uniform success. But we'd be happy to try and provide as much hard evidence, hard data, instead of the anecdotal things that we've had.
And, Mr. Chairman, I have asked for the first evaluation report from Hennepin County. I just wasn't able to get it for the hearing today, so I will get that for you. The other thing that Judge Hopper states is that initially you might not see, you know, a general reduction in overall cost because you are, in fact, providing treatment and trying to get people hooked up with stable housing. But the point that the judge makes is that you're spending the money one way or another. So is it more effective to spend it so people become, you know, well and, you know, getting a job and living stably in the community? Or is it, you know, or is it more effective to, you know, keep them in jail or send them to prison? And so, you know, he would certainly, I think, say that we're using it more productively through a mental health court than we would if we're just putting someone in jail, because these are the folks who come through, you know, over and over and over again.
Members, any questions? Senator Marty or Ms. Everholm?
Mr. Chairman, we will do whatever we can to provide more information. Again, what we were hoping for, would love to have, and I realize the constraints, would be some funding and to both develop the standards for other districts and also to provide some small grants to perhaps try and expand to a couple more districts. But we will, in the next couple of days, get to whatever we can get on it. Again, it's hard to measure it, but if we can get something concrete that would help you with your deliberations.
You clearly have to understand that we're in a financial bind, and that
I'm aware of that.
We certainly are willing to consider your request that we are going to need to do a lot of paring. So.
We're very aware of that, Mr. Chairman.
Members?
And I think this, again, with a lot of the issues this committee deals with, a lot of the ones that this bill deals with, are things that do reduce crime and they make the public safer in the long term, and it's cheaper in the long term because of that. But again, I realize that the issue is getting the money in the budget this year. So we will get you what we can as quickly as we can.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Is there anyone willing to move?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Senate file 859. I'll be laid over for possible consideration on those budget bill.
Heard the motion. Is there any questions or suggestions?
Council has pointed out that on the appropriation section, section 2, subdivision to discharge planning, that's probably more within the realm of the Human Services Budget Division. Now, the bill itself is within the Tax Committee. So, Mr. Chair, if there's some way that we could just call this to attention to Senator Berglund so that she can take a look at this in her budget division, that may be appropriate too, because that part would not be within your budget area. So,
okay.
Mr. Bacchus.
Members, just to remind you, what Senator Higgins did when she had this bill in her division was to delete Section 1 and then Subdivision 1 of Section 2, which really doesn't show up here. But, you know, to be consistent with that, we could delete Subdivision 3 and then keep that within our jurisdiction, consider it for your omnibus bill, and then send just Subdivision 2 back to full finance for Senator Berglund to consider.
I think that makes some sense. At least that gives a trail to get it there. So move that Subdivision 3 be laid aside as to be incorporated into – I'll split my motions, Mr. Chair. We'll withdraw the previous motion. Move that Section 2, Subdivision 3 be set aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus budget bill.
You've heard the motion. The discussion on that. All those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay. Motion to pass.
And then would it be the rest of the bill then? Okay, then I move that the rest, the remainder of Senate File 859, now as amended, be referred to the Finance Committee.
You've heard that motion. Discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay. Motion to pass.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We will get to it as quickly as we can. Thank you. Sarah Betzel, Senate File 624.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a bill that not only was heard in the Judiciary Committee, but if you look at the top of the bill, it actually got to the Senate floor before we had to pull it off and send it back here because of the opportunity to review this, which means that Senator Ingebrigtsen has not had the chance to hear this bill yet, but the other members who are sitting here who serve on Judiciary Committee have. This is more of a technical bill. It deals with clarifying changes in marriage procedures. Mr. Chair, there is one very technical amendment that was missed in the drafting of the bill, and I think we can take care of it here. If you look in, say, Section 1, we changed the terminology from court administrator to local registrar throughout the bill because these are the people who have the responsibility these days. That technical change was missed in one place, and that is on page 2, line 24. It still refers to the court administrator. And Mr. Bacchus pointed that out to me, that should now be changed to local registrar. As I say, that was just a technical matter that was missed in the drafting of the bill and was missed in the previous committee, but it's consistent with the rest of the bill. So I'd like to make that very technical motion, Mr. Chair.
Would you restate the...
Yes, on page 2, line 24... the word court administrator would be stricken and insert the words local registrar. And that is consistent with the rest of the bill.
Heard the motion. Discussion? All those in favor, indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay. Motion prevails.
And now, Mr. Chair, members, this does deal with some... the bill that is the jurisdiction of this committee deals with some fee matters. Now, and I'll call your attention to Section 2. Under current law, a minister of any denomination is required to record credentials in any county or state in order to perform wedding ceremonies. There's no fee whatsoever, so some counties charge nothing. The highest fee, I believe, is in Hennepin County. They charge $47. This just establishes a statewide uniform fee of $20 to record the person's credentials, and it's deposited in the county's general fund. So that just sets a standard statewide that we currently just do not have. You don't have to do it for every time you perform a ceremony. You just have to record somewhere once. And as I say, just because the counties are all over the map, this just has some consistency as to how much they should charge there because they have no guidance right now. That's what Section 2 does. Sections 5 and 6 deal with an increase in the marriage license fee, and this is the part that is retained by the counties. I have some witnesses here to testify that basically they're currently losing money from their part of the marriage license fee because we have not kept up
with the county's portion of it. So you will see on page 3, line 14, the fee would be increased from $100 to $110. And then if you go through a premarital education course on line 23, you get a break. That break was currently $30. That would be raised to $40, $10 increase. That's the $10 increase overall. And then the same $10 increase appears on page 4, the disposition of the fee on lines 19 and 32. And as I say, I do have interested parties here who can explain why the fee increase would be necessary. So I'll turn it over to them. Who wants?
Would you please state your name for the record?
Mr. Chair, I'm Sue Anderson with the MACO Committee, Vital Statistics Advisory Committee, and also I work at Anoka County, and I run a vital statistics office and do a license bureau administration. Part of what we're looking at is the cost for us is closer to $25 to process a marriage license application. And what we're looking at is bringing the fee up $10 so that the $15 that we currently get at a county level would be $25 and more in line with what it is costing us to process that application.
Can you tell me what you say it costs you $25 to process an application? What do you do for the $25?
Mr. Chair and Senators, we process it by we have a form that we have to have the applicants complete. That form needs to meet statute. That we have staff that need to be able to process an application, viewing ID in some counties, and verifying that all the information is obtained on the application. We process a marriage license, including with current statute, we have to issue 3 certificates and 1 license. That involves mailing it out or having the couple come back and pick it up. If sometimes there's typos and you have to reissue. Then once they're married, you have to record their license and image it and have it on file so that you can issue marriage certificates for them as long as they're alive and even after they're gone.
And perhaps, Mr. Chair, we can describe where the remainder of the money currently goes. The county gets to retain currently $15 and the rest.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
The other 85 has gone to the state, yes.
The state's general fund. The state collects the other $85, the county retains $15. So they're proposing to raise the fee by $10, so the county's share would be increased. And by the way, the last time the county's share, 1977, the county got $11 out of the marriage license, and in 1978, it was raised to $15 and has stayed that amount since. The state's portion back in 1978, well, by the way, is $15 as well. So back in 1978, the county got 15, the state got 15. And while the county has remained 15 all these years, by 81, the state got 30, 83, it was 40, 85, 45, 89, 65, 2002, 70, 2003, $80, 2004, $85, and 2005, $100. So there have been numerous increases from the state's portion of the marriage fee since 1978, but the county's portion has stayed stagnant at $15, while we've gone from the state's gone from 15 to 85.
It's too bad that we can't erase a number of those fees that we put in play.
It's often commented that maybe we should charge $5,000 for the marriage license, and then we'll charge $100 for the divorce. But it's the other way around. So,
any questions of these witnesses? We do have another lady. Are you going to testify for us, or are you just going to provide support?
Good afternoon, Senators. I'm Cheryl Parrish from Todd County, and I am also a local registrar here representing the MACO Vitals Committee today. And when we were looking at how much the county costs, it costs the county to process the application, we took into consideration the difference back in 1978. Most of the records were kept in a book. We've automated most of the systems, and so there's purchase of software, maintenance, supplies, mail. And when we originally were receiving $15, and through the years there's been more and more and more administrative fees attached to that. And what the local registrars would like to have the legislators consider is that it costs us approximately $25. We're not asking for 30, we're just asking for 25 to to bring it up to a more reasonable amount and to cover the costs.
But the costs for you may be reasonable, but the state part is
definitely. And that's why the local registrars have remained stagnant and haven't been in here since 1978 asking for more fees. Every year that they decide to come and ask for fees, another surcharge is added on. And so we don't want there to be a burden onto our customers. But yet, when in 2006 for Todd County, which is a medium-sized county, we processed 116 marriage licenses. For the state last year, Todd County deposited into the state $5,875 for those 116 licenses. The county kept 1,740. So I think there's a great difference in that. While many of the programs and the surcharges are they're good surcharges, they're good programs, but because of those good programs, the county is losing money on issuing marriage license.
Has this reduced the rate of divorce?
I don't know. Well, I did find very interesting, in 2002, there were 32,061 marriage licenses reported to the Department of Health. In 2006, there were 29,803. So it is less marriages.
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Mr. Senator Betzel, you can answer this. Why wouldn't the county be able to raise their own fees by themselves? Or is it in statute?
It's in statute, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Has it ever been talked about just letting them go ahead and handle their portion of this so they don't have to come back every time? Or?
Well, I don't know how long this has been on the books. Section 6 of the bill, you can see the current law, and that's where it says of the marriage license fee collected, it's currently 15 must be retained by the county. So it says in statute how much they can be retained. I suspect that if we were just to repeal it and let the counties charge whatever they want, they would raise it far above 15 because they're facing fiscal issues just like the rest of us, and they would see the opportunity to get some more money out of here, and then we have less consistency over the state. Right now the fee is the same regardless where you get married.
That's where it originated from.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, my parents got married in 1948. They paid $2, and it was only going to the county. The state got none of it until 1981, was when the state started receiving part of the marriage license. And they've taken greater and greater parts of it while the county's got a modest little share there.
Any further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, this is a bill that I believe can go on its own because it's so I'll move that Senate File 624 as amended be reckoned and passed and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
You've heard the motion. Is there any discussion on that? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay. Motion failed. Just to alert you, next meeting will be on March 15th. and we're going to be looking at presenting and passing our omnibus bill. So plan on it, and we should have a copy of the bill to your office by Wednesday for your review.
You all there? Okay. So no meeting next Tuesday.
Meeting. Next